too windy today.
Oh, it's Thursday.
So am I. Let's go have a drink. Welcome to Brookings Cafe. There's just no telling who might be here today as we venture in to quench our thirst. We call it our Great American Debate. We come to the discussion in the spirit of fairness and an attempt to offer something conclusive. We don't claim to be experts, but we will strive to come to the table prepared to discuss our topic. We are going to extend invitations to those we think may offer an opposing point of view, and in some cases we may extend a challenge to specific people or groups to defend their point of view. Beware we fact-check anything that sounds questionable, and we look dimly on mere opinions that aren't based in knowledge. We are trying to reach some sort of a resolution, something that both sides can settle on as an idea worth promoting. Oregon is a right-to-die state, but that doesn't mean that exercising that right is easy. It isn't easy, and a lot of people suffer needlessly because of all the paperwork, the cost, the waiting, and sometimes travel. It all takes a toll on what should be a sympathetic process. Oftentimes, people die from their terminal illness before the process is complete. But wait, there are even more hurdles. Here we discuss the issue in depth. Fasten your seatbelt. This isn't what you think it is. Death with dignity, perhaps. I'm Dan.
I'm Lynn.
I'm Lee.
I'm Ray.
And I don't really know where we should start, but maybe just a little bit of an overview of what your organization does. You're with Coastal Health, Home Health and Hospice. Is that correct?
That's correct, Dan. Okay.
So tell us a little bit about the organization to kind of start us off.
Coastal Home Health and Hospice, we are actually the only hospice. I'll talk specifically about hospice this evening. That serves Curry County, all of Curry County.
Mm-hmm.
And Curry County is part of Oregon, so Death with Dignity comes down to Curry County as well. But we're pretty isolated from all of the volunteers and everyone who works with the Death with Dignity program. So with hospice, what we do is take care of patients and their entire families at the end of life. Specifically, a prognosis of 6 months or mm-hmm. less with a terminal diagnosis. And we bring in, it's a team approach to care. We bring in, you know, a physician and a nurse and bath aides and volunteers mm-hmm. and spiritual care coordinators. There's an entire team that works on that case. And we get together every 2 weeks to talk about that case. And so end of life is what we take care of. Our whole point is dying without pain, with all the support that you need, as comfortable as you need. We bring the supplies. We bring the medication. We're kind of your end of life go-to.
Question. I think you told me once that the whole right to die aspect of things, though, is very separate from hospice. Is that right?
That's a very good point. Thank you, Lee. It's very separate. In fact, I work for hospice. We do not prolong life, nor do we hasten death. And we just keep you comfortable and keep you safe and out of pain. So all of a sudden, we were finding patients who their presumption, if I can back up a minute, I go to people's homes or to the hospital or to doctor's offices and talk to people about hospice. And it's quite surprising how often patients will say, yeah. When do I get my shot?
Mm-hmm.
They actually say that. It's kind of a joke actually with us. Yeah, when do we get my shot? That's not what we do. And of course, the point of that is no one talks about death and dying. No one talks about it. Nobody plans about it. I don't know what they think will happen at the end of life, but if death with dignity is part of your plan, all of a sudden they're at the end of their life. You know, death is in the house now, and hospice is all they know, and they associate it erroneously with the whole Death with Dignity Act. And so we have patients that just kind of assume that's part of what we do, and it's not even close to what we do. So thank you for bringing that up.
So if somebody wants to look into that aspect of things, assisted suicide, I guess is another word for it, who do they get a hold of?
They should have gotten a hold of, there's a wonderful organization in Oregon called End of Life Choices Oregon. Many of the people on their board of directors, the physicians and nurses, are part of the unique team that actually got that law passed 20 years ago. They've got highly trained volunteers, not on the coast, but over on I-5 and east. And so End of Life Choices Oregon is who you need to get a hold of. And they've been very helpful to me because all of a sudden I was confronted with, well, we don't abandon our patients either. And so here this patient is going, wait, no, I want death with dignity. And it's like, that's a whole different paradigm for us. Mm-hmm. And so I start studying up on it and reading the law and talking to their volunteers also about how does this work. And I started by helping a patient who said, this is a bunch of crap. I voted for this. Why can't I get this done? And she was amazing. And she pulled me in and she schooled me and I schooled her. And it was quite an fascinating process that people don't understand. It does not just happen.
Right. It isn't as easy as it's supposed to be. I'd like to back up a little bit and talk more about the hospice. Because like you say, a lot of people are confused about it. They think that as soon as you say hospice that you're going somewhere and they're going to chop off your head or whatever. A hospice is, it's actually care. And I'll throw my ex-father-in-law's example out for consideration. He was in the hospital and he had had cancer and he had gone through chemo and what have you to try to, you know, put that into remission or something. And so he was there lying in the hospital bed and the doctors were debating as to whether or not he was terminal or whether or not if he was going to recover from this. And there were like three doctors involved, I think, and then several nurses. And so he was building up fluid in his sinuses, and they would come along and stick a tube up his nose and suck the fluid out. And then he had another problem with some sort of an infection, so they ran a PICC line up his arm and wherever those things go. And they just were constantly doing all of these things that were tormenting him. And my wife at the time said, look, this man is terminal at this point. Why is it that we're poking and prodding and putting him through suffering needlessly? And so finally one of the doctors came in and then they had a conference and then they said, okay, the man is terminal. Let's not do anything to try to keep him alive. And then the whole process changed. And it was a whole different story because now at that point he was considered to be in hospice even though he wasn't going home or anything like that.
That was after your wife at the time opened the door to the discussion?
To the discussion, exactly. Because like you say, nobody really wanted to talk about it, but she did. She said, look, I mean, you know, who is this guy and what is it that we're trying to accomplish here? And so, I mean, once that decision was made, then he was a lot more comfortable. And you know, he probably died within 2 or 3 days or something like that. And I think, you know, they put him on morphine for his pain. And this was in Oklahoma. So Oklahoma's not a right-to-die state. So, I mean, he never had the option of considering assisted suicide or anything like that. But the point being, as I see it, that this hospice program essentially said, look, let's make people comfortable. Let's end the suffering that they're going to endure if, you know, if we're going to go this other route of trying to inject them with this or whatnot. Can you kind of give us a little bit of detail of what hospice really means?
Sure.
How long of a period of time is it? How do you get there? That kind of thing.
Our median length of stay is equal to the national median length of stay, which is 24 days.
Mm-hmm.
That's not very long.
No.
My mother was there for about 3 years.
That's awesome. I was just looking at those numbers today. We graduate people off of hospice. Mm-hmm. They're no longer declining. When they're not having to go to the doctor, mm-hmm. and when you wake up in the morning with a terminal illness, you and I wake up with, 100% in our tank. Terminal people don't. They wake up with 20%, and just getting out of bed, that takes 2%. Going to the bathroom, if they're still insisting and, want it to be mobile to go to the bathroom, that takes another 5%. Visitors, everything takes from their energy. So when you've got all of the healthcare coming to you, you've got people that are highly trained in a very specialized area of healthcare, palliative care, keeping you comfortable at the end of life. And the medications we use are very different. I was looking at the numbers today, and we have that steep slope that people are on when they first receive that terminal diagnosis of 6 months or less. If the disease progresses as the doctors think it would, well, once we come in, we bring such a team of people together that support the family and the patient. And instead of this, we're starting to come in for a smooth landing, for lack of a better word, if mm-hmm. that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Takes the stress off, so much support, makes it a lot more comfortable, and people can actually rest and maybe even mm-hmm. balance out for a while.
And give them time to, when I'm talking to groups, I talk about the death and dying in three phases. Shock, when you get that diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Stabilization, it's like, okay, hospice is here. We've got all kinds of experts, and we're used to talking about death and dying. We might pick up on the fact, Dan, that you might have a few questions that you're not comfortable asking in front of the family.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Dan, do you mind if we just have a little bit of time with you,
Yeah.
And so we're the experts in that field. We also would look at your wife and say, gosh, that woman is exhausted, mm-hmm. and she's still going and still going. What can we do? And, I'd kind of like to go and have my hair done. I haven't had my hair done in 2 months. We can bring a volunteer in, to help with that.
Mm-hmm.
But we have people on, we graduate people off of hospice, and some of them are on, we've had people on over a year, well over a year, mm-hmm. because they quit that rapid decline. And it gives you time with the shock phase, the stabilization phase, and then the transition when you're transitioning from this world to the next. If we have that time to where you can really tell us your story.
Mm-hmm.
We love hearing your story. And families learn a lot when you might be talking to we have certified nursing assistants, or the nurse, or I might be in there, or the spiritual counselor. And I told you every 2 weeks, we talk about every patient, the whole team. Mm-hmm. And I know our palliative care physician, Dr. Silver, here in town, that's always his first question. So tell me about them.
Mm. Excuse me, I'm not familiar with that palliative care.
That's a great question. Palliative care is
pain management?
It's pain management, but it's managing all hospice care. Is palliative, but you don't have to be dying to get palliative care. Palliative care can be medications. It can be massage therapy. It can be the kind of equipment that you need in your home.
Is this specifically for people that are terminal?
No, it can be all hospice care is palliative, but not all palliative care is for hospice.
Okay.
Palliative care is for seriously ill people, and it brings a whole different level of competency and expertise to what do you need? He really wants to go down to the beach. How can we make that happen?
Yeah.
That's not part of the medical piece, but that's still some things that mm-hmm. would be considered. People don't understand that on hospice, we get calls quite frequently from other hospices where patients are coming to vacation here. Hospice patients,
mm-hmm.
and their hospice turns them over to us. We got this, and we will take care of all their care while they're here. We have patients that need to go back and see the grandkids for one last time. We make the arrangements. So they've got hospice where they end up. So there's reciprocal agreements like that where we take care of one another's patients.
So in other words, if my family and I decided that I wanted to go back to Oklahoma to die on the prairie somewhere, and I was wanted to do that. I mean, there was some company somewhere, this is just an aside, that in as another alternative to being buried in the ground, cremated or whatnot, this company would just essentially dump you out on the prairie somewhere to return to the earth.
Great burial.
I don't know if they're still around or whatever.
It does not sound legal to me.
It is. Well, all right, spend a half a minute telling us about that. I'll set my watch.
Okay. there is green burial's a big thing now because all of us boomers, we changed everything mm-hmm. and we're used to stirring it up. We are used to getting things our way. We change things when we come together. And now we're on the downhill side and we're going, no. Oh, hell no. That is not how I want to die. I want to be environmentally, I want to be environmentally efficient about my death. And so green burial means a lot of different things to a lot of people. It can be literally wrapped in a shroud mm-hmm. and put in the ground. Mm-hmm. And yes, you can be buried in your background in Curry County if you want. My kids would freak out if I were to do that. But nevertheless, you can go to the courthouse and get that paper. You've got to identify that grandma's in the backyard.
Uh-huh.
And then you need to really think ahead. Okay, that's all cool, but what if the great-grandkids want to visit great-grandma's burial site?
And
after
the property's
the house
been sold.
Yes.
Or what if somebody wants to put an azalea bush there at some
exactly.
point?
Exactly. They need to know they're going to find
it's
grandma.
One thing to dig up the dead gerbil that you forgot you buried, but
which
digging up grandma
enough.
Is another story.
So in the green burial, if somebody goes and lays down on the prairie, that means the coyote comes and has breakfast on you? Or
there actually is a place in Colorado where they have funeral pyres. It's the only place in the U.S.
Oh, that sounds so cool. I like that.
This is a Native American.
There's a waiting list.
It's also worldwide, but...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, yeah, on the Ganges. Mm-hmm. You know, they do that all the time.
When we sold our house in Alaska...
With your wife.
Our house in Alaska had a particularly beautiful view that we loved, and my wife and I put years of blood, sweat, and tears into building this house. And part of the agreement for the people who bought the house is that someday a box or boxes will come in the mail. We'll have our ashes in, and showed that person where we wanted to be scattered.
Perfect.
And I mentioned this to my brother-in-law, who's an attorney, and he started telling me all of the legalities of this and that. I said, shh, go away.
Yeah. The green burial also, there are green burial, not prairies up by Portland, of course, but forests mm-hmm. where you just dig the hole and, you know.
You don't have to be embalmed.
No, absolutely not, because that defeats the whole green thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's home funerals are making a huge comeback, and there are people that can teach you about how to do a home funeral. You certainly don't have to have a casket. You can have a shroud. You could have a casket made of willows or cardboard that all the kids have decorated. It's very...
Yeah.
We are shaking it up when it comes to animals.
And I'll tell you, you know, through the 4 or 5 deaths that I have been through in the last few years in my life, one of the things that really irks me is the attitude that the whoever's running the funeral service, et cetera, you know, and they say, well, you could get this plain old box.
Yeah.
But over here we have this nice one that's made out of real genuine teak wood, and it's only $1,000, and you know, it's an industry, everybody's got to eat, but that's an industry that it's one of the ones that I just really don't.
A lot of people enjoy spending. I don't know if to say enjoy, but they want to spend that money on the funeral.
Point well taken, and that's important to them. And
when my father died, we were pretty poor people. But my mother made sure he had a very nice coffin because he would not have liked a cheap coffin.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very important. And it's very important to a lot of people around here. And the point is, whatever you want, let your value speak at the end of your life as well.
But here's the issue, as far as I can tell. I mean, I've always been very open about death and curious about death, too. And yet, I know nothing. I know absolutely nothing. And how can I make those choices if I don't know anything about what that process is going to be like? And of course, there's always the unknown of what's going to kill you anyhow. So you don't know. You're going to be gone in 5 seconds. It's going to take 2 years or five or what? So there's a lot of unknowns there. And I wish there was a way to understand the process better without necessarily being a professional or something like that, but just a lay person. I know when I was younger, I remember, was it Timothy Leary wanted to die, and I think he did, taking LSD. And I'm like, why would you do that? Why would you want to not experience that ultimate experience of life? But now, realizing as some of my relatives have passed, it can be kind of uncomfortable and painful. So do I want palliative? Do I want those medications that are going to dull my senses? Or do I want that experience? How do you make that choice? I don't know. But I need more information.
When the pain level gets to where the little guy's frowning,
yeah, there is a point where you just go, give me the drugs.
There have been times in my life when the pain was so severe, and I had hope that tomorrow would be a better day. Unfortunately, it was. But the pain was so severe that I said to myself, if I'm going to have to live like this for the rest of my life, I think I'd rather make another decision. My grandmother, I remember talking to my mom about this because she was in a lot of pain. She had macular degeneration. She couldn't read anymore. She had all sorts of physical problems, and she was in a lot of pain. And I remember I asked my mom, I said, if she's in this much pain, why does she continue? And the answer was, well, I think maybe she is hoping that tomorrow will be a little better. And so, there comes a point, I think, for me anyway, in my thinking, when if the pain level hits the little frowny guy, then I'm going to look at options.
You're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. You kind of know when you've had enough, I suppose.
Yeah.
And that would be something that you would have to determine along the way if you can. Mm-hmm. And that's another
part. And that's where hospice comes in. We're experts at this. I'm not a nurse or a physician, but I work with some of the best.
Mm-hmm.
Because I specifically moved here because I wanted to work in a medically underserved area. Because of all the things
that
you get to learn.
Oh, we love you for that. We really do.
It's amazing. I'm a death doula who happens to work at a hospice. What were we talking about? Totally lost my train of thought.
About the pain management aspect?
Oh, they are experts, and they're highly trained and experienced. And the medications that we use are very different than you would get in the doctor's office or the hospital. And by different, I mean our physician and our nurses, they work together to just tweak it.
Mm-hmm.
Just tweak it little bit, down, down, no, up one. That's really important because are you savoring the moment? I mean, are you lucid? Is it too much pain? You don't care about those grandkids in the room? We need to change that. We need to do some things different. How about simple things like I would notice about, how about we turn the lights down?
Mm-hmm.
How about we be quiet? Could the kids go outside and play?
Or play favorite music loud.
Exactly.
The situation I was recently we had some spiritual person that wanted to play Tibetan bells or some damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm down with that.
I put on Stairway to Heaven and other songs and played them what most people consider too loud. I asked this person, I said, is this bothering? And she says, no, I love it.
You can get lost.
But
I
still lost because the Tibetan bells came back on because they didn't think she knew what she wanted.
That's kind of the presumed thing.
Several years ago, I went to visit a friend who was dying in the hospital. And one of those things you're sorry you do because then that's how you remember that person. But anyway, and they had a little radio right on the little nightstand by playing music very softly and classical music or something like that. I went home and told my wife, I said, no, I want Jimi Hendrix and I want the neighbors complaining.
I love that.
None of that classical crap with the little radio.
I love that. Yeah. With the little...
And this
exactly,
is,
yeah.
This has got to be one of those struggles in that I, the one who is dying, would like to be able to listen to the good old rock and roll music, and my family insists on doing it their way.
Exactly.
Do you remember? Yeah. That's why we all need a death plan. I spent the first half of my life as a birth doula.
Uh-huh.
I was managing hospitals and stuff like that, but my passion was, you know, teaching birth education, being a birth doula. We all had birth plans. Did you have a birth plan?
No.
So, yeah, oh, I did. I picked the day and the time and everything. You know?
The birth plan is, what do you want? What do you think you want?
I would have picked other than Brooklyn if it had been me.
And we all need it. In my opinion, we need a death plan as well, mm-hmm. because there's going to come a point where you can't talk about it.
Yeah. And as you say that, I think about my will, which is in the safe, which needs to be updated.
Yes, where it should never be.
We put all of that stuff off because we don't want to think about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Lee, I wanted to go back to your point about where do I learn about this? Where do I find out about it? Because we're boomers and we're stirring it up when it comes to, this is our time. This is our death. It's been going on for 20 years. It started in England, where hospice started, by the way. Mm-hmm. Death cafes. And they're all over Oregon. They're even in Eugene.
Really?
I've been wanting to start one here. And I'm going to do that real soon. It's a place where you have coffee and you have cake and you talk about death. And my role would be simply to facilitate and make sure it's not a place to air your grief. It's not a grieving space.
These are the dying people that are the families?
Anybody.
Okay.
It's a death cafe where you can come and talk about and think about and ask about death and dying and just talk about what's on your mind.
Even if I'm perfectly healthy, et cetera, I can go in there and put together my death plan with the aid of these people in a death cafe.
Yeah. And you could say, what is with this whole body donation thing? And someone in the room will probably know about it. How does that work?
I can picture that occasionally having somebody coming in who it becomes obvious they're contemplating suicide.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and
that
what happens then?
I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psych. If I'm there facilitating, yeah. I would start with that right away.
I mean, they don't say it outright, but as the conversation continues on, you say, this person's thinking about killing themselves.
Oh, yeah. What would I personally do? Are you asking? Or
well, how would that? How would you handle that? I guess if you were the facilitator.
To my knowledge, anywhere in the world that has never happened doesn't mean someone wasn't thinking and we never learned about it.
Yeah.
But usually these are pretty articulate, curious people that really, because nobody talks about death, it's like this magical thing behind the door, and for me. Birth and death are so synonymous. And I talk about that when I'm talking to groups. It's like everybody's tense. They don't know when it's going to happen. There could be pain or not pain. There might be people walking in the room that you don't want. I mean, that's what it...
And everybody's afraid of offending everybody else.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Or not afraid enough.
Yeah. Not afraid enough. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah. If you just tuned in, this is a discussion at Brookings Cafe on KCIW, and we're discussing basically death with dignity, the various options that are available. And we're here with Lynn Dene, who is
I'm a death doula. I work for Coastal
doula.
Home Health and Hospice, where I have, in that role, I am the volunteer coordinator and the outreach manager.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So
you're the person to contact if I have any questions. I want to move on to this idea of your own being able to arrange your own death the way you want it, assisted suicide.
Before you go there, though, okay. I just want to say this death cafe. That's a brilliant idea. We should definitely do that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's make it happen, and you could possibly facilitate
yes,
that.
Yes, I'd be. It's really fun because the stuff that comes out and the people that come. And
we'll pack up our microphones and just go right there.
It is because you have to go there.
Yeah,
because you opened up the door.
Yeah. So I kind of want to start this with, I know there's an individual in town who is very much into trying to come up with solutions for an abnormally high suicide rate. Oregon is abnormally high, is it not? It seems to me that that's
I'm afraid I couldn't even begin to answer that. I don't know.
I think I've heard that that's true.
Okay. So at any rate, there are great efforts to talk people out of, help people ease through, essentially move from wanting to take their own life to sort of rehabilitate them into thinking in terms of living life as they want to live life and so on. So I don't want to confuse the two issues.
Absolutely.
There's suicide that we want to prevent, but then there's the right to my own death if I so choose, and I want to talk about some of the options. But first of all, let's just launch into the what does it take? A doctor tells me that I'm terminal. I'm going to die sometime in the next 6 months, and that's probably going to be very painful because I've got a combination of this, that, and another, or whatever. And I think to myself, I think I would rather opt for it. So where do I begin?
Start with knowing who your advocates are. You need two doctors,
okay,
that are going to say that it would be fascinating for you to have the end-of-life people come and do this, because mm-hmm. they could really go down the rabbit hole. So you need, anyway, I'll go down the rabbit hole as much as I can. Two doctors who determine that you do have a terminal diagnosis,
mm-hmm.
and it left as it is, that is very probable your death, your demise would happen in 6 months or less. So two doctors. You need to make an oral request that starts a 15-day counter.
A waiting period.
A waiting period.
Hmm.
During that day, then you also need to get a consulting doctor. During that 15 days, make mm-hmm. the first oral request, get a consulting doctor. And the one thing I found, I'm so grateful for our patients that kind of pushed me to go down and figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had always heard, first of all, we didn't talk about it. I've only been here 5 years. And when I started, you do not talk about death with dignity. Just don't, because we don't kill people. We help, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I heard that you had to go clear to Portland to find a doctor because you have to make an oral request. So my first question, and this only, I only dove into this last spring at a patient's request. And an oral request, well, to me, that doesn't mean face-to-face.
Telephone.
Video.
Video.
Why do we have to do that? And I found that that's how they do it over in the corridor. They do a lot of telemedicine, because when you're dying, first of all, most people don't come to us until the last few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
It's too late.
Mm-hmm.
The average time it's going to take you to complete this process, first oral request, second oral request, and the things that need to happen in the middle. Let me go back a moment. When I said find your advocates, this is a really emotional thing for physicians, for nurses, for families.
Mm-hmm.
There's not any doctors going, yeah, let me sign that. Yeah, and let me write that prescription.
Because their MOS is to save lives.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's what they've dedicated. That's what they do. And it's emotional, too, because they've got a relationship with this patient.
Yeah.
I called a doctor about 2 months ago to let her know that her patient had taken the medication and died. And this was her first time that she had written a prescription. She's over in Eugene. And she started crying. I did too. She goes, I didn't know it would be this hard.
Mm-hmm.
There are serious emotions and all the stuff that comes with that involved. So I know for me, I've asked my physician, hey, if you ever are going to give me a diagnosis, I want to know right now that you're on my team, because you might have to spend weeks finding a doctor that will
mm-hmm.
document that oral request, that will agree to write the prescription. And then there's forms that you have to fill out. There are places in Oregon, California, Montana, Washington, where the pharmacist won't fill the prescription. Nobody has to do this. It is, and there's hospices. Right now, if we have a patient that was their option, the nurses will trade off. If the nurse says, no, that is not part of my belief system, that's fine. You know, we'll work around that and get another nurse. So there's all of those dynamics, but the average length of time it's going to take you to do all those things in the 15-day waiting period is really expanded, because this doctor, he hasn't got that signed yet, and this doctor hasn't been able to see you yet, and
this doctor doesn't want to do it,
so find another one. So get a plan in place. If this is what you want, have your players, have your healthcare proxy, the person who will speak for you when you can't. Please make sure they are comfortable with this, if this is your chance, because they might say, oh yeah, I'll be your healthcare, you know, proxy, and I'll answer for you. I can speak for you when you can't. Are they down with this? I don't know. You need, not always is that the case. So there's a lot, you need a plan if this is your plan.
This goes back to this idea of having a death plan.
Yes, yeah. I know, I have spoken, especially in Curry County, I'll speak to some of these tough old loggers, oh, just take me out and shoot me. Well, that's really not a plan. That's not a plan. So come on, Bob. What do you say? We talk about what you want.
And a lot of it, I don't know what the statistics are. I remember once I saw National Geographic had this beautiful graph on what you're going to die from, and it was circles. And the first two big circles were cancer and heart disease. And then there were all the smaller circles, fire, automobile accidents, and stuff like that. But so much of it, as I was looking at this, and I realized, you know, death can happen a lot of different ways. It can be a heart attack. It can be you get smacked by a truck. It can be things that happen instantly right now. It's not necessarily something that's you're going to be laid up in the hospital for months and then finally be diagnosed with this or that. So not having, like in my case, not having the will updated, you know, yeah, I need to go back to the death plan. What am I going to do if I get smacked by a truck? And
who knows how are they going to get in that safe? Just ask it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, somebody needs to know where the key is. Yeah, putting together a death plan then isn't necessarily something that, to me, sounds easy. It sounds to me like it's something you really need to sit down and do some hard thinking about, and not wait until somebody says that you're terminal.
Yes.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things out there online. There's one program that I really like. It's called Five Wishes, and you can go to their website, fivewishes.com or org, I think it is. That one of the most important things about advanced planning is, no, I don't want tube feeding. Yes, I do want this. But the really powerful part of those is when you write in your own handwriting, why? Why? Because if you can't speak for yourself and you've got a child or a spouse that's going, oh my God, I can't do this. I can't do this. But right here, Dan told you why this was important to him. That's so helpful. And kids fighting over, no, you're killing mom. We've got to, you know, have a death plan. I have my kids get really tired of hearing me talk about it. I call it my drop dead file. And I have a spreadsheet with all my passwords, all of my account numbers, everything about my life that they, because I'm a very pragmatic person. And I don't want my kids to have to sort and try to figure out, what is CTR? Garbage? What, you know, they live in DC and Boulder.
Right.
So they're not, and who my friends are, who I don't want at my funeral, who better not show up. Don't let them come to my deathbed. I don't want a hospital in the living room. I want it in, move the furniture out of the bedroom. I want a safe little cave where, because I was really into birth. I'm really into death now. It's like, this is going to be work, and I want to be focused. And I think I want, they call it thanatology, by the way, I want special music that is kind of geared to my breathing and my heartbeat. I think that's
Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, really loud.
That is what I would like, seriously. I have a hearing loss, and when I first realized I had a hearing loss, I went to see the doctor, and he said, what can I do for you? And I said, I want you to tell me how I can sue the Jimi Hendrix estate. But how long has this hospice thing been in existence? You mentioned before that it started in Europe.
It did. I think 1982 is when Medicare finally decided to start paying for it. Hospice started out, and so in the States, it started out as all volunteer.
Hmm.
It was pure, it was gorgeous, and we are nonprofit. I want to say that right. We're nonprofit. So we still are we're totally focused on the patient and the family. We don't just take care of the patient. It takes a village to take you across that, you know, line, through that curtain, whatever you want to call it. And most hospices are for profit now. And but they're about, I think about 10%, max 20% are not for profit. But it started in 82 when Medicare, probably officially, because now people would pay. It used to be all volunteer, but now people would actually pay. Tax dollars would pay for this kind of health care. And there's some amazing things happening all around in this country with how we handle death and dying.
I had a relative who died a couple of years ago, and she slipped into Alzheimer's and got to the point where she didn't know who anybody was. She was in the hospital for, it seems like, maybe 18 months or so like that, in virtually a vegetative state, and they just kept her alive, kept feeding her, and, you know, her two sons were both saying, she doesn't want to be like this. Why does she have to be like this? And this was in Pennsylvania, and they just said, well, we can't just stop feeding her. And
that's ignorant.
Of course, by the time she did die, there was not only no money left, but I'm sure the government had paid a whole heck of a lot of money.
Yeah.
Well, and one of the things that I have is called a living will, which essentially says that if I'm being kept alive by artificial means, I want them to pull the plug.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the death plan, basically.
Yeah, advanced directive, you know, living will.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so you need to have a will, you need to have a living will, you need
power
to have
attorney.
Power of attorney, you need to have all of your passwords and what have you in a spreadsheet.
That's what I do, my drop-dead file.
You're not the only one. I've heard more people that do that.
Then I get real paranoid when I have to send it. It's like I'm going to send it in a PDF, and I'm going to, and I hope nobody gets, it's crazy.
I keep everything on a yellow pad.
Oh,
that's
everything.
And we go through the house looking for Ray's yellow pad.
Oh, five or six of them, and then you just
even
have
easier.
To, you have to page through each page.
And try to figure out what we're looking at.
Show scripts. I have grocery lists, building plans, everything.
Okay, so let's see here. We need some 2x4s.
Exactly.
We need a cardboard box and markers.
And what songs I'm going to play this week is all, might be right under the 2x4s or in between the 2x4s.
Be like him. He'll leave in our will that we have to continue his show for another 3 years. I want to talk about the various means by which I can take my own life if I want to. Mm-hmm. You were talking about drugs. That the right to life, right to death.
Death with Dignity Act.
Death with Dignity Act gives us. Is that it? Are those my only choices? Can I swallow rat poison if I want to?
If you want to, but don't ask us to come and clean it up, okay?
Rat poison's not a good.
Figure it would be, but.
Yeah. And no guns, don't do that.
Yeah, that
no
makes
guns.
A big
or if
mess.
You do
messy.
Go outside, don't do it in the house and leave a mess for somebody to clean up. I was a police officer in my former life, and I've been to many of those scenes.
I've been to a couple.
Bedroom is splattered.
And then what if it doesn't work?
And what if it doesn't work, exactly. So I have to tell my joke real quick about, no, I don't want it.
Well, your question is a very good one.
Yeah.
Because we will actually tell patients, sometimes they tell us too late because they're afraid of hospice because that means they're dying and they don't want to talk about that. and they get on hospice, and we've only got them for 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And on average, many of them from a year, more than a year. But you can stop eating and drinking.
And that's fairly effective, and it's fairly painless.
It's very effective. It's called, it's called VSED, voluntarily stop eating and drinking. Mm-hmm. It's a medical term, and we will actually tell our patients, but it sucks, and nobody wants to do it. It's like, bring me that pecan pie.
Bad enough you're dying, and you got to be starving and dying of thirst, too.
No. And I know it's, I recall one patient where that was her plan. For a lot of people want to know options because of religious reasons.
Right.
And that was her plan. And it's like, so a day or two would go by, and then it's like, oh, the hell with this. Bring me a pie. Bring me a hamburger.
Yeah, I would think a terminal diagnosis would be an excuse for me to start eating red meat again. Yeah. Bring that prime rib in. Mm-hmm. Load it down with...
Yep.
Well, I know of a couple of cases where, one in particular was... one of my ex-mother-in-laws, I always have to qualify everything to tell people I've been married 48 times. But an ex...
Did we judge you?
Mother-in-law, I hope not. An ex-mother-in-law who died of cardio problems. And within 3 or 4 weeks, her husband, who they had been married for like 70-some-odd years or something like that, and he just went into like super depression. And then the next thing we knew, he was in the hospital, and nobody really understood why, except that he wasn't comfortable, et cetera. And they couldn't really find anything wrong with him, but they realized he had essentially decided to quit eating and drinking. Well, he was drinking some, mm-hmm. but he was just eating less and less and less. And so finally, one of his daughters said, well, you know, he's comfortable. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have anything to live for anymore, so who are we to judge? That's the story to share there. But I want to go back to, you were talking earlier about that there are like two different drugs that are available. Is that it?
No. And you know what? I don't, like I said, I'm not a doctor. And so, but there's several different prescriptions that a doctor, and the pharmacist will work with the doctor to decide, you know, what is the best. And they range from $4,000, $600 to $4,000. And probably one of the most important things I'd like to say is why having a plan is important is as your terminal disease progresses, mm-hmm. the body has a very natural, normal way of shutting down.
Right.
And part of that is, you know, that you see it in facilities or you see it even in patient homes, food means love. So everybody's trying to feed someone.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth of the matter is digestion stops. Mm-hmm. You quit processing food. You quit taking in nutrients because everything's starting to shut down. And the most important organ is the heart and brain
mm-hmm.
to get oxygen, you know, going. So if you can't process nutrients, mm-hmm. if you've got any kind of colon blockage with tumors or lots of nausea, so you keep throwing things up. Death with dignity prescriptions are not an option for you.
Hmm.
You're not going to keep it down.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of, that's why I say, if that's your plan, please don't get on hospice and then ask us to try to help, because we'll do our best, but all we can do is just kind of facilitate your process. And in the meantime, you know, death is in the room.
So
you can't swallow. You can't drink.
The law dictates what medicines can be used?
That's a great question, and I don't have an answer for you. I know that there are certain medications, and they change the medications as reports from doctors come in. Of the 143 prescriptions written last year, 143 died. There were 218 prescriptions written. 143 died, actually ingested the medication. 14 of those got their prescriptions in an earlier year. Out of that, 218, there were 48 ingestions that had healthcare providers there. There's a misunderstanding that doctors and nurses can't be there. We can't mix it. We can't participate. I'm not a doctor or nurse, but none of us can participate. This is your thing. You've got to be able to do it yourself. But we can be there. We don't abandon patients.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can be there for support, you know, for the family and for you. Some hospices will be there right until you mix a medication and take it. Then you can call them back after you've fallen asleep. Hospices are kind of all over the board and how they're trying. It's been 20 years, but we're still feeling our way.
So how long does this medication take?
Excellent question. I just wrote that down. From ingestion to unconsciousness, and that is in this report too that I gave you from Oregon Health Authority. The median time is 6 minutes from the time you take the medication to the time you're unconscious. And from the time you're unconscious, ingestion to death is from 10 minutes to 21 hours that's the span. Some of them were like 30. I mean, there have been some really long ones because every physical body's different. Every disease process is different. Did you not tell did you eat something? You're not supposed to eat something before you take that. Some people do. Or they have issues with digestion and absorption. It's so different. And it's just like birth. You don't know.
Mm-hmm. I've had the unpleasant experience of being there to have pets put down by the vet. And I often wonder this when I see the executions being failed and everything. And the vet puts a needle in a vein, and before the syringe is empty, the animal is dead.
Yes. Well, these don't go in the vein.
I know that.
It's got to be absorbed, and that's the difference. Absorbed through the gut.
Okay, so that would not be a legal way to do this?
No. That would be euthanasia. That would be illegal if someone else is doing it. But if you're doing it yourself.
Okay.
Yeah, and you know what? There had to be some legal issues when this law was being written, because I'm sure that was brought up. Surely that was brought up. But some ethical, you know, because no, that's euthanasia and this is, you know, aid in dying. I don't have a good answer for you.
Well, it seems to me that there are a whole lot of better ways to kill yourself or to conduct an execution than a lot of what's being proposed. I have known people who have done the helium, the plastic bag, the helium, and I think in one of the cases that I'm remembering, it involved a lot of alcohol and a lot of psychedelic drugs or something
and
like that.
And a balloon but, and helium? What is that?
A plastic bag. I mean, helium's inert. It's akin to, well, I think there's an organization, the Hemlock Society, I think is the name of the organization. And I remember my parents talking about this many, many years ago. They actually sent off and got the little kit. And the only thing that you need to do then is to go to your party supply store and buy a tank of helium. But helium's not the only thing that'll suffocate you. You can do it with carbon dioxide. So you could conceivably do it with a seltzer bottle.
Car exhaust.
Yeah, go in the roll down all the windows in the car and fire up the car in the garage with the door closed.
Yeah.
You know, spending $6,000 for some medication that I'm not even sure how I'm going to feel in the last few minutes or whatever. Having suffocating.
Or if you'll be able to. That's always the key. Can you?
Will you be able to?
Because you've got to do it yourself.
Yeah.
Can you do it? Can you swallow?
So it seems to me like there ought to be some sort of a little button or something like that. I think we have about 3 minutes left here. So in this, we're talking with Len Dene, and she is with, and this is a discussion at Brookings Cafe. We're talking with Len Dene, and she is with Coastal Home Health and Hospice. And so we're getting a bit of a dark education, if you will.
It's not about, dark, Dan.
Well, it depends on how you look at it. I mean, you know, sometimes you can look at it and it's gallows humor and you can laugh about it. And other times, you know, it's no, people get upset about these kinds of things.
And they do.
Like you say, they don't talk about it.
Right.
And so we are. So I'm just trying to be honest about what the show is all about.
I appreciate that.
What can you add in the last couple of minutes here that I should know as someone who is contemplating jumping off a bridge?
Okay. What bridge are you doing this on?
A low one, because I'm afraid of heights.
Oh, you're afraid of heights. So you've got a bad plan going on there, Dan. That's all I've got
to
say about that. One thing I'd like to leave you with is, hospice does not kill you. We do not prolong your life, but we don't hasten your death either. And yes, some of our patients, actually there were only 12 last year on the whole coastline, that we don't utilize it on the coastline. I don't know why, but we do have some patients that opt for, they actually move here, you know, because that's part of the plan, to participate with Oregon's Death with Dignity. That's not part of hospice. Please have a plan.
Two separate subjects.
Yes, thank you. And and we don't abandon our patients. We will help you as much as we can, but frankly, you should have had a plan probably before, long before now. Know what your doctor thinks and feels, what your family thinks and feels about it. Because when you're on hospice, only, you know, hopefully you have 6 months or more, but usually you're afraid to go on hospice.
Mm-hmm. And it's all such a big mystery.
It is a mystery.
And it's something that people really should take seriously enough to at least sit down now.
Yes.
And put together some sort of a plan. But for me, so, okay, I'm going to go pop open the safe and update the will and the living will and all that sort of stuff.
And call us. We are happy. I'm happy to come and talk to groups about what really happens when within the death process. How does the body shut down? How can you help a dying person? That's what we're experts at. And we're not talking about it. We're not putting a plan together. We're not talking about it. Please, it's.
Today's the
day.
It's
happening.
And it's a new year, and you can make a New Year's resolution, and ta-da.
Ta-da.
Yes. Yeah, cool. Okay, well, this has been Discussion at Brookings Cafe. We've been talking about death with dignity, perhaps, and it's not as simple as you think. And please feel free to listen to the show again if you would like. We've been here with Len Dene, who is with Coastal Home Health and Hospice. Pi White has been our fabulous engineer who makes sure that I sound great on the radio and everybody else doesn't sound quite as great, except for Ray, who has this golden voice. And so so I want to say thanks. And please don't write the station with questions about this subject.
Oregon. Call End of Life Choices, Oregon. We are just telling you, hey, people are out there. People are wanting this option. Make a plan. You know, it's not as easy clear cut as you think.
All right, cool. Thank you very much, Len.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. It's been such an
enjoying evening, gentlemen.
Lee had to go to another engagement, and so she left, and nobody knows.
Yeah.
But thank you, Lee.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.